Good morning. This is AM. I'm Tony Eastley. A United Nations committee is calling on the Vatican to immediately remove all known and suspected child abusers from their posts and hand over their files to police. In a damning report, the UN's watchdog for children's rights lambasted the Vatican for implementing policies it said allowed thousands of children worldwide to be abused. The Catholic Church, in turn, has accused the UN body of interference and of being out of touch. Europe correspondent Barbara Miller reports.
The report by the UN Committee on the Rights of the Child pulls no punches, Committee Chairwoman Kirsten Sandberg.
The main finding of the committee was that the Holy See has adopted policies and practices which have led to the continuation of the abuse by and the impunity of the perpetrators.
The committee said the Church should remove immediately from their positions all known or suspected child abusers and hand over any case files to relevant authorities. It was damning of the practice of moving known abusers from parish to parish, saying this had placed children in many countries at high risk of sexual abuse. Barbara Blaine is the president of the US-based group SNAP, Survivors Network of Those Abused by priests.
I will confess I am a bit pleasantly surprised. This is what we as victims have been saying for decades. And the brave survivors in Australia who have spoken up, this acknowledges what they have been saying. And I believe it also affirms the necessity for the Royal Commission that is taking place in your country today.
Why are you pleasantly surprised?
You know, we have been trying every which way we can to get church officials to step up and do the right thing. And what we've learned over time is that the only time that they take even the barest of minimum of steps is when they are forced to from external sources.
But they won't be forced to either. These recommendations are not in any way binding.
Well, I understand that the UN does not have any kind of prosecutorial authority, but it is the United Nations. And I believe what's most important is for the secular authorities, for the heads of state of every country in the world, should read these recommendations, read this report, and take action.
The Vatican has said it will thoroughly study the report's recommendations, but has defended its record on combating sexual abuse. Archbishop Silvano Tomasi is head of the Holy See's delegation to the United Nations in Geneva.
It is very difficult, I think, to find other institutions or even other states that have done so much specifically for the protection of children.
Few expected this report to be so damning, but there's little indication so far that its harsh words will result in any action. This is Barbara Miller reporting for AM.
A peak body for the nation's vegetable growers is urging the federal government to look at an alternative way of funding SPC Ardmona. AusVeg says dumping duties, which may soon be imposed on Italian tomato imports, could be used to upgrade SPCA's processing facilities. Samantha Donovan explains.
This week, Australia's Anti-Dumping Commission has found that just over half the Italian processed tomatoes sold here have been dumped. That is, they're sold at a lower price than in their home market. The Commission says that's led to a drop in sales, price, profit and jobs in the Australian tomato industry. It's recommending to the federal government that exporters of the Italian product now pay dumping duties. AusVeg represents about 9,000 vegetable and potato growers nationally. Its deputy CEO, William Churchill, is pleased with the Commission's findings.
As we've seen some of the duties that are being proposed, that there's two importers that are going to have a tariff of 26% added to their import duty, and nine other importers are also having a tariff of 5% put forward. Now, this isn't a done deal just yet. It needs to go up to the Assistant Minister for Industry, but we hope that with the recommendation that's been given by the Commission, it will get the go-ahead and we are to see some relief given to the processing tomato industry in Australia.
SPC Ardmona had asked the Anti-Dumping Commission to investigate the Italian tomato imports and the company has welcomed the findings. It says more than 90 exporters refused to cooperate with the Australian authorities and they'll all receive the same penalty rate of more than 26%. AusVeg's William Churchill says the dumping duties could now be directed to SPC Ardmona.
So the way the money is going to be collected, it's possible for these duties on Italian tomato imports to be invested in SPC. There's an opportunity for the government to actually look at it and go, well, what money could be raised from these duties? Could it go towards the $25 million co-investment that SPC was requesting? So there is an ability here for the government to maintain its policy pledge, not to do corporate handouts, but also be able to find a way to actively assist SPC with the new refurbishments that they needed to do to their factory.
William Churchill says the United States sometimes redistributes import duties in this way, and Australia should follow the American example.
There's the Dumping and Subsidy Offset Act of 2000, which allows for the annual distribution of dumping and countervailing duties to affected domestic producers, which again essentially can involve farmers and manufacturers. It's done overseas, and it's certainly something that we could consider doing here to assist the Australian tomato industry.
William Churchill from AusVeg, Samantha Donovan, our reporter. Extracting gas through fracking has provoked controversy in Australia and overseas, with concerns about the potential impact on land, water and human health. Now, Western Australia believes its proposed new shale gas fracking regulations, which it says are some of the toughest in the world, provide the right balance. The government has just released draft rules to beef up penalties for companies that pollute water when fracturing rocks to release natural gas. Dr. Tim Griffin, the Deputy Director General of WA's Department of Mines and Petroleum, has been speaking to resources reporter Sue Lannan in Perth.
They're largely focused at well construction and well operation, and it's looking at the way the well's constructed, the way the well is managed, but also it looks at the impact on water and groundwater supplies, which are so important to the state, and the way that they can be contaminated, and we address those issues to ensure that they aren't contaminated. The other big impact is on when the wells are finished and completed, and make sure that that's done properly and that there's no chance that there'll be any further problem from that well.
This has been an issue in the US, the abandonment of wells. Will these regulations be tough enough to stop companies drilling a well and then just leaving it when they've finished?
Oh, most definitely. They're designed around that, and I guess we've had a lot of experience in Western Australia with our oil and gas drilling, both onshore and offshore, over a very long time. And really this set of regulations is just bringing those new regulations up to the modern world.
What about the management of water? There has been concern from some groups in the community about water resources and whether fracking would contaminate water resources. So what do these regulations do to address that?
We've got great experience around managing the integrity of a petroleum or gas well to make sure it doesn't contaminate the water, groundwater, but we're also looking at the advances in technology, the new changes that are happening, and making sure that our regulations are picking up on those better systems that allow us to manage that activity, ensure that there isn't any contamination.
Would that stop you fracking in a particular area if that was a risk?
We would not allow a petroleum well or gas well to be drilled if we felt there was a risk of water contamination in any way or form. It's something that we're very, very focused on.
There's also going to be harsher penalties for companies as a result of these new regulations. Are the regulations not tough enough at the moment?
The regulations probably aren't as clear as they could be, and I think that's really what we're focused on. In terms of penalties and things like that, we're recognising that we'll apply the maximum penalties if there is a problem with this, with people working in these, operating these wells, and they do break the law or break our rules and regulations and guidelines around it.
These new regulations and the overhaul of the state's petroleum laws, has that been in recognition of the problems that other places like the US have had with fracking?
That has played a part in this. In fact, we had a review, the Tina Hunter review. It looked at our capacity to regulate this unconventional gas, as it's called internationally, and recognised we did have some weaknesses in our system. From what we're seeing and the evidence we've been collecting and analysing that very carefully, we feel we've probably got some of the strongest, if not the strongest, regulations in the world to manage this industry.
Dr. Tim Griffin from WA's Department of Mines and Petroleum with resources reporter Sue Lannan. And you are listening to AM around Australia, where it is 19 and three quarters of a minute past seven. So exact. Australian snowboarder Belle Brockhoff, who has arrived at the Winter Olympics in Sochi, has stepped into the controversy of local politics, speaking out about the violence targeting the gay community in Russia. The 21-year-old gay athlete from Victoria says she hopes Russia will change a controversial law on security. Human rights activists say the law which bans giving information about homosexuality to minors has been used to crack down on gay rights activists, and it's coincided in a rise of gay hate crimes. ABC correspondent Matt Brown reports from Sochi.
It's a standard drag show. Under the flashing lights of the Lighthouse nightclub, Nikita is flouncing about, pumping out an energetic performance, bedecked in a sheer pantsuit, fake breasts and buttocks, and an impressive blonde wig of the decidedly vampish variety.
Welcome, Russia.
The club's been operating for decades, but it's especially noteworthy because Sochi's mayor says the gay, lesbian, bisexual and transgender clients and performers simply don't exist. Their rights and welfare are in the Olympic spotlight because Russia's passed a law making it illegal to give information about homosexuality to minors. It's already been used to prosecute gay protesters, including one man who simply held up a sign declaring that it's normal to love gay people, but a crime to kill them. Nikita says she's concerned the law could stoke gay hate crimes. Fortunately, there are fewer cases in Sochi than St. Petersburg or Moscow, she says. But the mentality of the Russian people means many are cruel to gays. Now, gay rights campaigners have staged global protests, asking Olympic sponsors like Coke, Samsung and Visa to speak out against the laws and pressure Russia. There's also a campaign called Principle 6, sponsored by an American clothing company. It's a reference to Principle 6 of the Olympic Charter, which opposes all forms of discrimination. And Australian snowboarder Belle Brockhoff has signed up. She's gay, and in the lead-up to the Games, she came out in opposition to the law. On her way here, she said she was worried that if she spoke out during the Games, she might be targeted by Russian officials. But as she arrived at Sochi Airport, she was still determined to speak her mind.
I've seen many documentaries about Russia and some of the violence towards the LGBT community, and it's sickening and it's sad. And like, hopefully, if I get a medal, I'll be able to use that platform to point these things out and hopefully get a change. But you know, if I don't get a medal, not many people want to listen to my opinion.
So it's all about the performance on the slopes then, isn't it?
Exactly, so added pressure. Like, okay, it's Putin's country and he can do what he likes with the country, but what I'm worried about is the safety for the LGBT community. You know, obviously there's a lot of violence, torturing and, like, torturing to death almost. And I'm hoping to see change after these games.
Australian snowboarder Belle Brockhoff ending that report from our correspondent Matt Brown in Sochi. The CVS pharmacy chain in the US is more than just a chemist shop. It's a huge enterprise offering a wide range of goods. So when it announces it's stopping its sale of cigarettes, it's big news. North America correspondent Jane Cowan reports.
CVS is a pharmacy that also sells household goods and some groceries. Now it's set to become the first US pharmacy chain to take cigarettes off its shelves, a move that will cost the company about $2 billion in annual revenue. But CVS president Larry Merlo says it makes sense.
Tobacco products have no place in a setting where healthcare is delivered. And when we asked ourselves where we expect to be in the future as a healthcare company, it became clear that removing tobacco products from our stores is the right thing to do.
Professor of Medicine Stanton Glantz directs the Center for Tobacco Control, Research and Education at the University of California in San Francisco and says the decision is tremendously significant.
I think it is going to contribute to reducing smoking because people who go into CVS pharmacies, and there's over 7,000 of them, are not going to see tobacco products advertised. They're not going to be helping to normalize tobacco is a normal part of life in the United States. They're not going to be there to promote impulse buys that would make smokers who are trying to quit relapse. You know, it's just incongruous and stupid to have an organization which is part of the healthcare system selling death.
The move comes as the U.S. Food and Drug Administration launches what is, incredibly, its first ever national anti-smoking advertising campaign using new powers bestowed by Congress. Instead of warning about the health risks of cancer and heart disease, the ads focus on how smoking will affect young people's looks. One ad shows a teenager buying cigarettes at a convenience store.
Pack of cigarettes, please.
He then pulls out one of his teeth with a set of pliers to pay for them.
What's a pack of smokes cost? Your teeth.
Smoking can cause serious gum disease that makes you more likely to lose them. What are cigarettes costing you?
Smoking remains the single largest preventable cause of death in the US, killing more than 480,000 Americans every year. About 18% of the population currently smokes, down from more than half of men and nearly a third of women in 1964. In places where there have been aggressive anti-smoking programs, like California, rates are as low as 11%, and youth smoking rates in the single digits. Professor Glantz.
I think if we could add to that the kind of innovation that Australia's been pioneering, particularly plain packaging, we could be down to the point where smoking essentially disappeared in California in 4 or 5 years. And I think if the Obama administration ever grew a backbone on the issue and started implementing the policies that we know work nationwide, we could be rid of smoking as a public health problem in under 10 years.
President Barack Obama says CVS is setting a powerful example, and the decision will help his administration's efforts to reduce tobacco-related disease and bring down healthcare costs. This is Jane Cowan in Washington for AM.
People from wealthy areas drink more on average than their poorer counterparts. Research into factors that cause excessive consumption of alcohol has debunked the idea that it's more common in lower socioeconomic areas. Natalie Whiting has more.
The study of 20 regional centres in New South Wales looks at community factors that predict rates of excessive drinking. The lead researcher is Professor Anthony Shakeshaft from the National Drug and Alcohol Research Centre.
What we actually found was that communities that had more pubs and clubs per capita had higher rates of binge drinking, and communities that were wealthier had higher rates of average consumption. And interestingly, we also found that communities with more police had lower rates of average consumption.
Mr. Shakeshaft says the findings are applicable to suburbs in metropolitan areas and regional communities in other parts of Australia. He says the finding that wealthier communities drink more was surprising.
There's a sort of sense that it's the opposite, that poorer communities and lower socioeconomic status people have higher rates of consumption. But in fact, this shows it's the opposite, that those communities with more money actually drink more.
The study looked at both binge drinking and high average consumption. He says while there are well-publicised issues associated with binge drinking, like alcohol-fuelled violence, high average consumption is also dangerous.
Higher average consumption associated with cancers, things like cirrhosis, and also higher rates of mental health problems. And incidentally, also drink driving. The higher average consumption is across the population, disease and drink driving, those sorts of incidents tend to get higher as well.
The report found communities should invent or tailor strategies to address their specific issues.
The obvious one would be using, you know, planning laws to restrict the number of alcohol outlets. So that probably would have a significant impact on both average drinking and potentially also binge drinking.
Professor Mike Daube is the alcohol spokesman for the Public Health Association of Australia.
What we also, I think, learn from this is that as well as the overall approaches, we have to target different communities differently. As well as the across-the-board approaches we need for alcohol, communities themselves need to look in the mirror and identify what specific problems they have and what local activities will work there.
He says current regulations being rolled out by the New South Wales government, such as enforcing stricter lockout times in the Sydney CBD and closing all bottle shops earlier, are still vital in reducing excessive drinking.
It is so important to recognise that the problem isn't just a Sydney problem, it's not just a King's Cross problem. There are alcohol problems in communities around New South Wales, as this study shows, and around the country. So we shouldn't just rely on action being taken in the middle of Sydney. We need action at the national level and at the state level, but also at the community level.
The study has just been published in the Australian and New Zealand Journal of Public Health.
Natalie Whiting reporting. To the financial markets, the Dow Jones in late trade not doing much at all, up 13 points. The dollar is buying 89.1 US cents. It's fetching 65.8 euro cents. I'm Tony Eastley. Thanks for your company, and that's AM for today.